Subject's heart will beat if instructed to do so, and sometimes when subject is not paying attention. There are no negative consequences to stopping the blood flow. Experimental evidence suggests this state can persist for at least 6 hours and 42 minutes. Longer time periods have not yet been investigated as the subject grows bored with testing. In spite of the intermittent blood flow, there are bruises on the subject's skin that have not faded and show no signs of healing or yellowing. The bruises are arranged in a ring around the subject's neck. The pattern of bruising suggests the injury occurred. My scientific report on my own apparent mortality stops mid-sentence. I told myself as I was writing that I found my own affected detachment silly and mildly embarrassing. The same way it became embarrassing to play make-believe with friends long after you knew it wasn't real, but long before you were ready to admit it wasn't fun anymore. I keep my notes in an ordinary 70-page wide-ruled spiral notebook. On the cover is the NASA seal and a picture of the space shuttle Discovery. I've had it since the summer after sixth grade, when I wrote an essay about what space exploration means for the future of humanity and won a trip to a 2-week space camp in Houston. They gave us the notebooks on the first day, but I never used mine except to write my name inside the front cover. Breezy Lynn, astronaut, in outrageously bold block letters. I didn't want to ruin the rest of the clean, empty pages with my looping, childish handwriting. They gave us NASA pens, too, which didn't even last the full 2 weeks, and pins and stickers and patches to iron onto our backpacks. When I got home from space camp, I put the notebook in my desk and forgot about it. After I woke up in my backyard grave and went home, it was still there, sitting at the bottom of the drawer beneath a pile of birthday cards and postcards, notes Melanie and I had traded during ninth grade geometry, bad poetry and embarrassing lovesick letters sent to me by a persistent crush. The notebook and pen were the only things I took from my room when I left. Nobody would miss it. On the first page, there are a couple of blank lines below the paragraph. Then, I've been missing for 1 year. I woke up buried in somebody's backyard. I don't remember dying. I don't remember. Chapter 9. The list is on the next page. 1. Sleeping pills. An entire bottle. Choked down in several handfuls. In retrospect, it was a pretty stupid thing to try. If you can't sleep when you're dead, you definitely can't sleep deeply enough to never wake up. That's also how I discovered that all of the things I had learned in anatomy class about the digestive tract being controlled by the autonomic nervous system didn't apply to me anymore. I can make myself breathe, can make my heart beat, but I haven't quite figured out how to make myself digest what I swallow. It sloshes around in my stomach until I make myself throw it up. My gag reflex works just fine. 2. Drowning. Lake Michigan is right there. I entertained brief and undignified thoughts about a future as a deep-sea treasure hunter while I was beneath the surface, but otherwise suffered no ill effects. 3. Rat poison. Our neighbor Mrs. Feely left her garage open one night. Same result as the sleeping pills, only with more self-induced vomiting. 4. Gunshot. Heart, not head. The biggest risk was the number of houses I sneaked into before I found a loaded weapon in somebody's bedside drawer. I was trying to be undiscriminating in my search, but it turned out the middle-aged white guy with the pickup truck and the racist anti-government bumper stickers did not responsibly lock his weapons in a safe. I was so shocked. 5. Electrocution. It only occurred to me afterward that if I hadn't picked the right spot, completely by chance, I would have given some train operator or security guard a heart attack. I ruled out public locations after that. 6. Hanging. Boring. Also, hard to get down once I was dangling there. 7. Stabbing. Bathtub, kitchen knife. I knew by then nothing was going to work. I couldn't die. No matter what I did, the wounds healed. They hurt. Every single one. pain like I had never felt before. They bled. They burned. They left scars. But they healed. The list was pointless. But it was all I had. I didn't have any answers. I didn't even have the right questions. All I had was data. And all the data told me was that sometime between the moment I had died and the moment I woke up, I had become something unnatural. Something not alive, but not dead either. And I wasn't going to figure it out sticking knives in my stomach and watching my blood trickle down the drain. Chapter 10. The old woman's name was Helen, and she insisted I let her buy me another cup of coffee. I smiled shyly and sat with my backpack in my lap, my skateboard leaning against the side of the plastic booth. I told them the story about the irresponsible roommate and the change of plans. "I only needed a place to get cleaned up," I said, "and a ride to the nearest Greyhound station." They made the appropriate noises of sympathy and agreed that while they didn't know anybody who attended that church, they were Methodists, you see, and went to First Methodist on Grove Drive when they went to church at all. Pastor Willow at the Church of the Prairie sure seemed like the right person to ask for help.
"We'll get you set right up, Katie," said Helen. "Don't you worry."
Katie was the name of Melanie's older cousin, the one who had run off years ago to be a jazz musician in New Orleans and stayed after Hurricane Katrina to rebuild houses for charity groups. The real Katie was tall with dyed red hair and had a voice like an alcoholic gospel singer. "I don't want to be any trouble," I said. That was the only protest I offered. I had willingly gotten into the car with a murderer the day before, just to see what would happen. I wasn't worried about accepting help from strangers. Helen patted my hand and volunteered to make the call when I admitted I didn't have a phone. Her skin was liver-spotted, but her touch was warm, and I let myself be reassured. For 2 weeks, I had been on my own with my secrets. It was a relief to have somebody else take over, if only for a little while. Even if she was a killer. Helen couldn't hurt me. Her frail old shadows barely felt like guilt at all. Her car was a boat-like brown Buick that coughed and trembled. We drove north out of town, away from the highway, until there was nothing but muddy fields striped with young crops as far as I could see. Helen never pushed the car above 45. We made awkward small talk during the long, slow drive. She was happy enough to chatter about her children and grandchildren who were coming to visit in a few weeks, even though they always complained there was nothing to do in Nebraska in the summer. Riding bikes and climbing trees in the sunshine and fresh air wasn't good enough for kids anymore. Not like it had been when she was young. She didn't mention a husband. I wondered if he was who she had killed. The better part of an hour passed before Helen slowed the car and said, "Here we are." The sign beside the road announced the Church of the Prairie in bold white letters, and below that, "Jesus is help in times of hardship. Sun service AM." But there was no time specified. There was a cross atop the sign, the name and number of a Bible verse painted on the wooden frame. Helen put on her blinker and turned off the road, over a culvert running with rainwater, and into a gravel parking lot. The church was a boxy wooden building, topped with an old-fashioned spire, white paint peeling and faded. Beside the church, the heads of white crosses and gray headstones peaked above the grass. An old man stood at the edge of the cemetery, shoulders hunched in a blue jacket, head bowed beneath a brown fisherman's hat. Next to the cemetery was a small playground wrapped in a chain-link fence. The structures were metal, rusted, paint falling away in patches, and the swing set was crooked, as though half its double-A frame was sitting on quicksand. Two kids kicked on the swings in the rain. A woman in a red raincoat watched them from beneath a black umbrella. She turned as we passed, but she didn't wave. Her face was shadowed by the hood of her jacket. At the end of the muddy driveway was the farmhouse and barn, both surrounded by a quivering cluster of cottonwood trees. The house was desperately yellow, weathered, as badly in need of fresh paint as the church. The windows on its upper stories looked toward the road like twin rows of eyes. Small purple flowers poked out of the woodchip mulch in front of the porch. "Oh," I said. I swallowed and rubbed my palms over my knees. "It looks nice." It was anything but nice. It was bleak and cold and unwelcoming. It was the ugliest shade of yellow I had ever seen. There was nothing nearby. No other houses, no farm buildings. I couldn't even remember when Helen and I had last passed another car on the road. My heart was thudding, and I felt a nervous twist in my gut. I wanted to tell Helen to turn the car around and take me away. She parked in front of the house, but she didn't turn off the engine. "This is the place. They're expecting you." I hesitated before putting my hand on the door handle. "It's kind of in the middle of nowhere, isn't it?"
"Right in the heart of God's country."
Helen's smile was brief and watery.
"Go on. No need to be shy."
I forced myself to return to smile and thanked her for the ride. I ducked into the rain and jogged to the front porch of the house. As I climbed the porch steps, the door opened.
"There you are!"
The girl in the doorway wore a long flower print dress with an old-fashioned lace collar, and her red hair was split into twin braids over her shoulders. She could have been cosplaying Little House on the Prairie, but I had a feeling this wasn't dress-up. She was in her 20s, fresh-faced and pretty in a forgettable way, except for her astonishing green eyes. The color was so startling I wondered if it might be contacts. "Hi," I said. Behind me, Helen was already leaving. I fought the urge to run after her.
"You must be Katie,"
the girl said. She waved at Helen, received a brief horn tap in response.
"Pastor Willow said you were on your way. Lunch is just about ready."
Then she smiled, and I nearly missed the last step. I recognized her. I had seen that smile before. My mind flicked through school and camp and summer, but nothing fit. I knew I had seen her before. That smile and that pretty red hair, the freckles across her nose and those green eyes. But I couldn't remember when or where.
"Yeah, I'm Katie," I said. For the first time since I had left Evanston, I felt guilty about lying to a stranger.
"I'm Violet," she said.
She stepped aside to let me in.
"I hope you like potato and cheese soup. I know it's more of a winter food, but it's so gloomy today, I thought it was right. Come on in."
The front hall of the house was just as virulently yellow as the outside. The walls were papered with an alarmingly cheerful sunflower pattern, and an array of photographs in white frames marched in neat lines down the hallway and up the stairs. There were dozens of photos, more than I could count.
"Those are all the people Mr. Willow has helped," Violet said. "We keep the pictures around to remind ourselves how important our work is."
"Wow, there are a lot of them," I said.
Some of the photographs were old, with faded colors and fashions right out of the 70s or 80s. But most were more recent. They were all posed portraits of men and women looking toward the camera, but rarely directly at it. Distracted. Their minds elsewhere in spite of the photographer's best efforts. Some were smiling vacantly. Most weren't.
"Mr. Willow has been helping people for a long time," Violet said. "That's him and his father."
She pointed to a photograph of a broad, unsmiling bear of man in a winter coat, standing beside a much skinnier teenage boy in corduroy and a patterned button-down, with a tragic bowl haircut and a vague frown.
"His father founded our congregation," she explained. "It's a very sad story. But Mr. Willow always says that adversity is an opportunity for us to learn our true strength."
The men in the photo weren't touching. They didn't look much like father and son. In the corner, somebody had written the date, 1973. "What happened?" I asked.
Violet's smile softened. She wasn't a killer. She had no shadows clinging to her. Her smile was so light, her expression so kind. I wondered if they would even dare.
It's better that he tells you. Do you want to get cleaned up before lunch?
I guess I should. Do I really look that bad?
You can do laundry, too, she said with a laugh. I have some clean clothes you can borrow. I'm glad you're here. It's been so quiet this week. Usually there are a lot more of us. Oh, here's Esme. Say hi, Esme.
In the front room, there was a woman sitting in a wheelchair with a blanket folded over her knees. Her face was slack, and she was thin in a wasted, unhealthy way, and she had a faint scar stretching from the corner of her eye down to her chin. Her shoulders hunched under a threadbare bathrobe, and her hands were clenched on the arms of the chair. There was a towel tucked into the collar of her shirt. Somebody had covered her up to help her eat, but had forgotten to take it away when they were done. The woman turned her head when Violet said her name. She stared at me, her wide brown eyes unblinking, until I looked away.
She's a little shy, Violet said,
and she smiled again, that same friendly smile, and I remembered where I had seen her before. Not in person. We had never met. But I had seen her face and her smile, and I had heard her voice. That's what I remembered most clearly. The sound of her voice when she screamed. Chapter 11. Every year since first grade, Diane Fordham invited a group of us over for her birthday party at the end of the summer. And every year I went to her big white house with a gift in hand. The inside of the house was just as white as the outside. White sofas, white carpet, white walls, white artwork in white frames. The only thing in the living room that wasn't white was the cross on the wall, about 6 inches long, plain polished wood hanging above the white fireplace. I hated walking through that living room to the stairs. I worried I would leave tracks on the carpet, and Diane's mother and father, a tall, stern couple who worked for an investment firm, would look down their thin noses and scold me for bringing dirt into their home. It felt like a test, crossing that white living room, and I never exhaled until I reached the stairs and the relative safety of Diane's second-floor family room. All through the night, we would make excursions to the kitchen for snacks and soda, to the front door when we ordered pizza. But we were always quick, always careful, and every single time Diane said, "Don't spill anything." Every time. She had been hearing it her entire life. She blurted it out without thinking. It was fun when we were little, that yearly sleepover with so little supervision. But Diane and I grew apart as we grew older, and her birthday party became a tiresome obligation. The rest of us changed, started caring more about sports and boys and music and college and the future. But Diane was still Diane, with her bedroom of girly ruffles and lace in that albino mausoleum of a house. The August before our sophomore year of high school, the invitation came like it always had. A pink card in a square pink envelope, my name and address written in Diane's curling cursive. My mother had left it on my bed with a copy of Scientific American and another letter in a regular white envelope. I recognized the handwriting on that one, too. I set it aside without opening it. I already had a collection of Ricky Benning's awkward notes and terrible poetry in my desk drawer. Melanie thought it was hilarious, and at first I had agreed, secretly pleased to be the object of somebody's attention, even a loser like Ricky Benning. But now it was only embarrassing. I opened Diane's invitation and called Melanie.
"I can't believe she invited you," Melanie said, laughing. "I thought for sure you'd be off the list this year. You have a reputation now."
I was lying on my bed in my basement bedroom. The day was hot and sticky, but the basement was always cool, even through the long summer afternoons. The glow-in-the-dark sticker stars on my ceiling were faint yellow smudges against the off-white paint. Melanie's words stung, but I wasn't about to let her know. I remembered my Aunt Colleen giving me a warning a few years before, as we were fixing Thanksgiving dinner. Colleen had said,
"You have to be careful, Breezy. I know it doesn't seem like a big deal now, but nobody ever cares about having a reputation until they've got a bad one."
Melanie loved that I had a bad reputation now, but she hated it too. She hated that there were things I had done before her, without her help, without her input. Her jealousy was petty, needle-like, deployed at unpredictable moments. I didn't have any defenses against it. Not against Melanie. Not against my best friend.
All I had was the naive hope that after 3 months of summer, nobody would care anymore about the rumors that had raced around before the end of the school year. Mostly true, but not completely. I did have sex with Michael Chafford. My first time, and he knew it. But I didn't know he had a girlfriend at the time. And I definitely didn't beg him to introduce me to all his friends for a whole summer of repeat performances. I don't think anybody even believed that last part. Everybody knew Michael couldn't tell the truth about girls or sex if his life depended on it. But what they believed and what they laughed about were two different things. After a few weeks, I had realized that denying Michael's version of events wasn't making any difference. So I chose another tactic. I told anybody who mentioned it that fucking Michael had been the dullest 3 minutes of my life, and I couldn't even be sure it had happened at all.
That's how little I felt. Emphasis on the little.
Maybe it wasn't in line with Aunt Colleen's well-meaning advice, but I had decided, as soon as ninth grade ended, that it was better to be scornful than shamed. It didn't matter anyway. Not after Sherry Kostova turned up drunk on the first day of school and wrecked her car on the third. And not after a junior named Samantha French announced that he was now Samuel French, and the teachers and counselors scrambled to put together sensitivity groups and stumbled over pronouns. Not after Lindy Oliver went off her meds and threw a chair across the room during Mr. Park's class discussion about Ethan Frome. There was always somebody doing something more shocking, more outrageous, more interesting. I was completely irrelevant by the time our sophomore year began. But I didn't know that yet, during the last week of summer, and I was tired of not knowing how much to care. I put my feet up on my windowsill and dropped Diane's invitation on the bed beside me. "Well, she did," I said. "Are you going?" Melanie laughed again.
"No way. Don't you think we're a little old for pizza and stupid horror movies now?"
I did, but I went to Diane's birthday party anyway, mostly because I was angry at Melanie for deciding who among our acquaintances would still want me around and who wouldn't. I wrapped up a present in gold and white paper, rang the doorbell, smiled when Diane's mother answered. Mrs. Fordham's expression was distant and cool. "Diane and the others are upstairs. I'm so glad you could make it." She didn't greet me by name. I wasn't sure she even knew it. After the party the year before, as I had been rolling up my sleeping bag and shoving my clothes into my backpack, I had heard Mrs. Fordham saying to her daughter,
"Why don't you ask that nice Oriental girl to help you study? They're very good at school, you know. It's part of their culture."
I didn't hear Diane's answer, but she never did ask me to help her study. I hurried through the white living room, conscious of my shoes on the carpet, of Mrs. Fordham's eyes on my back. I gave her a quick smile before running up the steps. Diane was there, of course, and her two best friends, Courtney and Julie, but so were Maria and Tatiana. I was relieved to have at least two real friends for the night. Diane unfolded herself from her corner of the sofa and stood to take the present from me.
"Thank you,"
she said stiffly. "I didn't want to invite you, you know." I was surprised by her directness. I knew Diane didn't like me very much, and inviting me to her birthday party was more habit than anything else. But we usually pretended. We were pretty good at pretending.
"But my mom would wonder where you were if I didn't," Diane went on. "She doesn't know what a slut you are. I wasn't going to tell her."
"Jeez, Diane," Maria said. "You don't have to be a bitch about it."
But she laughed, because Maria laughed at everything. And I had to laugh, too. Melanie would love to know she had been right. I had managed to get dirt all over Diane's pretty white house, even without spilling a thing. Diane ignored me for the rest of the night. We watched a movie about college kids getting murdered by a professor possessed by the spirit of a serial killer. And when it was done, Diane ordered pizza and dragged Courtney downstairs to fetch soda and chips. When they came back, Diane had a DVD case in her hands. It was plain on the outside, printed words and no pictures. She tucked it between the arm and cushion of the chair before we could see it. Tatiana asked her if she had any alcohol, just to see how she would react. And Diane informed us that nobody in her family would ever drink. The pizza arrived. We scattered paper plates and napkins all over the room, and Maria launched into a story about her cousin in Mexico who had decided to hitchhike through Central and South America, all the way down to the tip of the continent, and the trouble he was getting into, the people he was meeting, the mornings he woke up confused and disoriented after partying with strangers. It sounded equal parts fun and terrifying. And when Maria was finished, Julie said she would like to do something like that. Something brave and adventurous, maybe after graduation. The rest of us agreed in the way of girls who had 3 long years before after graduation meant anything. A safe distance from which all wild ideas were possible. But not Diane. Diane only said, "That's awful. He's going to get himself killed." Then she carried the DVD over to the player, put it in before any of us could get a look at it. "We're watching this next."
"What is it?"
Courtney asked.
"My youth pastor gave it to me," Diane said.
Courtney groaned and rolled her eyes. Diane glared at her.
"It's not like that. It's not a church thing. It's better than a horror movie, because it's real."
"It better not be a church thing," Courtney said. Julie asked,
"Is this the hot youth pastor you told us about?"
Diane blushed.
"He's married," she said,
and we all laughed,
almost like we were friends again.
She turned off the lights again, took the remote, and pressed play. The first minute or so was completely black, no titles or credits or anything. Then the film began. It was low quality, like it came from a cheap old camcorder, or a found footage movie made to look like it did. There was a plain bedroom with a twin bed, nightstands on either side, a single lamp, and dull beige walls. The camera was at the foot of the bed. There was a girl sitting on the bed. She was maybe 7 or 8 years old. She was wearing blue flannel pajamas and playing with a stuffed rabbit, making it hop across the bed to one side and back again, narrating its progress in her little girl voice. She called him Mr. Rabbit. Her red hair was messy, her smile sweet. If she knew she was being filmed, she didn't show it.
"What is this?" Maria asked.
"Shh!" Diane hissed. She was staring at the screen, rapt. Footsteps sounded and a man passed in front of the camera, and another approached the bed from the side. The one on the left held a Bible and wore a priest's collar. The one on the right said,
"Hey, sweetie, you remember Father Matt?"
The little girl smiled at the priest. She looked happy right up until her father took the rabbit out of her hands. Then she began shaking her head and squirming. The men grabbed her arms and legs to hold her still, but she didn't make a sound.
"Oh, you've got to be kidding me," Maria said. "Come on, Diane. This is dumb."
Diane ignored her and turned the volume louder.
"I have like 30 Catholic aunts and uncles and cousins, and all of them know stuff like this is bullshit," Maria said. "We should be watching The Exorcist instead. At least that's not boring."
"If this is real, it's child abuse,"
Julie said. She looked sick to her stomach.
"They're helping her," Diane said.
A second later, one of the men on the screen said,
"We're helping you."
"It's not real," Maria said.
She didn't sound like she doubted it, but she was still watching.
The two men held the girl long enough to tie her down. They used cloth straps on her wrists and ankles. A woman's voice was speaking off camera, saying over and over again,
"Don't hurt her. Don't hurt her. Don't hurt her."
Stuck between a plea and a prayer. I wanted the camera to rotate. I wanted to see what kind of mother would let men do that to her daughter. Even if it was fake, Diane's youth pastor had to be seriously messed up to give that to a 14-year-old girl and tell her it was real. Courtney said, "Definitely fake. It's some kind of stupid viral marketing thing." And Julie said,
"Nobody even thinks movies like this are good anymore."
The man on the left picked up the Bible. He didn't open it, just held one hand over the cover, and he began to speak. He had a weak voice, too quiet for the camera, and most of what he was saying was monotonous and dull. After he had been listing names of saints for a while, Maria and I began talking about something else, and when Diane shushed us, we settled for folding her discarded gift wrap into paper planes and chucking them at each other. On the recording, the girl struggled a little against the bindings, more annoyed than pained. A few times she looked beseechingly toward her father and the woman off-screen, but still she did not speak. Her lips were pressed together so tight they were a thin white line. The priest hesitated in a few places, watching the girl warily. He made it through addressing the unclean spirit, ancient serpent, impious one, etc., finally landed a firm amen, and fell quiet. His face was red, as though the recitation had exhausted him. He touched his hand briefly to his chest and winced. The other man said,
"Try again."
So he did, from the beginning. But the girl had had enough. She began to whine and whimper, tugging at her bonds with restless impatience. The priest stuttered, and he reached out to touch her head. The girl jerked away and shrieked. It wasn't an expelling demons from her soul shriek, more like a tantrum in the grocery store shriek. But the adults reacted like she had started screaming bloody murder. The girl's father flung himself at her, clapped his hand over her mouth with an audible slap, and in the background the mother was saying,
"Oh no, no, honey, you know you have to be quiet."
The girl twisted away from her father's hand and shrieked again.
"I don't want to!"
The words were so much louder than they had any right to be. Each one landed like a stab in the ear, piercing and sharp. Julie grabbed the remote control from Diane and turned the volume down. Diane didn't look away from the screen. The girl shrieked again. The girl's father clasped his hands to his ears. The priest stared at the girl in shock.
"You're not."
The girl screamed again, and that time her shout stretched out into a wail, rising louder and louder until it drowned out whatever the priest was saying. His face grew redder, his eyes wider. He touched his hand to his ear, stared at a spot of blood on his finger. He pressed his hand to his chest again.
"What's wrong with him?" Tatiana said.
We were all watching the video now, our conversations and wrapping paper planes forgotten. The girl screamed one more time, and the priest collapsed. The woman shouted,
"Father, are you okay?"
She and the man jostled around the bed and knelt beside the priest. The man said,
"Go call 911.
And the woman sprang to her feet. She knocked the camera askew as she went by, so that it was pointed at an empty corner of the room. But we could hear the little girl saying,
"Is Father Matt okay, Daddy? Is he okay?"
The screen went dark, and white words appeared. Father Matthew was dead before the paramedics arrived. Officials refused to investigate. The video ended. There was no "coming soon." No title. No studio name. No credits. "That's it," Courtney said. "I can't believe you made us watch that die. This is so dumb.
It's not even scary.
Did your pastor get that off YouTube?
Julie asked.
That was so stupid. Let's watch a real movie now.
Diane clicked the DVD carefully into its case.
You shouldn't joke about it. A man died.
Not for real, Maria said.
Put on whatever you want,
Diane said.
I don't care.
She vanished downstairs for a long time. We were most of the way through Carrie, the original version with crazy Sissy Spacek, all the way to the start of the prom, before Diane came back to her own birthday party. None of us mentioned the video she had made us watch. We were afraid to find out just how seriously she took it. Tatiana found the video online a few days later. It had about 1 million hits. It was widely acknowledged to be a hoax, but there were still dozens of comments asking if anybody knew if the priest had really died, or if the little girl had ever gotten rid of her demons. I didn't get an invitation to Diane's birthday party the next year, and the last time it would have been possible I was dead and buried. I wondered if Diane even cared that I was gone, or if years of routine childhood friendship meant nothing in comparison to the triumph she must have felt, given the general agreement that I had gotten what I deserved. Chapter 12. Violet showed me to a bathroom on the second floor. I took my time in the shower, lingering until the water was lukewarm. It had been far too long since I last felt clean. When I was done, I toweled my hair dry and dressed in Violet's clothes. The flower print dress was too big, but the scratchy collar was high enough to hide the bruises around my neck. I sat down on the closed toilet seat and took my notebook from the backpack. I held the pen over the page for a minute or two, but I couldn't decide if I needed to add demonic possession to the real list yet. I didn't know what I had seen on the video at Diane's house. I was less willing to dismiss the possibility that it was real now, but I tucked my pen and notebook away without writing anything. I needed more information. When I emerged from the bathroom, Violet was nowhere to be seen. I poked my head into the only open room on the hallway. A middle-aged woman sat by the window, knitting a pink baby blanket. "Hi," I said. The woman didn't react. Her wooden needles flashed with astonishing speed. She wasn't watching her hands as she worked. She was staring out the window with wide, unblinking eyes. "That's really pretty," I said. "I like the color." The woman gave no sign she knew or cared that a stranger was standing outside her room. I watched her for a minute or two, waiting for her to notice me. But she never did. The stairs creaked as Violet returned. She smiled and said, "You look better." "I feel better, thanks." I glanced at the knitting woman, looked to Violet for an introduction, but Violet only said, "It will be a little while before lunch is ready. Would you like me to show you around first?"
"Sure, that would be great."
I didn't care about the tour, and I didn't care about lunch, but I was curious about Violet. I wanted to know how the screaming little girl in Diane's video had ended up at a church in Nebraska. I remembered that I was supposed to be stranded, so I added, "I do want to go online and check the bus schedule if I can. I don't even know where the nearest station is."
"Oh, don't worry about that," Violet said. "We'll get you where you need to be."
Esme was no longer alone when we went back downstairs. Two men had come in while I was in the shower. One was young and dark-haired and unsmiling. Violet introduced him as Esme's brother, Lyle. He had pulled a chair close to Esme's side. He plucked the towel from her collar and smoothed the blanket, tucked it around her legs, his motions hesitant and awkward. He wasn't used to taking care of her. He glanced up when Violet and I stopped in the doorway. Esme made a sound in her throat. Lyle answered with a soft shh-shh murmur.
"And this is Pastor Edward Willow," Violet said.
Pastor Willow wasn't what I expected. Part of me had expected him to be the exorcist in Diane's video, and part of me was looking for somebody gawky and young,
like the boy in the photo. But he was middle-aged and clean-cut, his blonde hair lightly mussed, his smile warm and welcoming. He wasn't as broad as his father in the picture, but he wasn't skinny anymore either. There was a mist of rain on his hair and a shadow clinging to him that only I could feel. He was a killer. I smiled and shook Mr. Willow's hand. I didn't let myself grimace when I felt the darkness coiled and quivering inside him. His shadow was small, so feeble it seemed to vanish the moment I noticed it.
"Welcome to our home, Katie," said Mr. Willow.
He clasped my hand with both of his and looked me in the eye.
"I'm so glad you found your way to us."
"I really appreciate the help," I said. "I feel stupid for getting stuck like this." I gave him an abbreviated version of my made-up story. Flaky roommate, missed ride, traveling parents. I had repeated versions of the story so many times it was taking on a life of its own. This time I told them my roommate had run off with a girlfriend, not a boyfriend, just to see how they would react. I was a little disappointed when Mr. Willow didn't even bat an eye.
"We'll get you where you're going,"
Mr. Willow said, exactly as Violet had said only 5 minutes before.
"How did you find us?"
"Danny," I said, "not Daniel. I met him in Omaha. He told me if I needed a place to crash, I could come here." A quick glance passed between Violet and Lyle, but Mr. Willow wasn't looking at them. He grinned and said,
"You were lucky to run into him. Danny's always felt very strongly about paying forward the kindness shown to him by sharing it with others. Is lunch ready yet, Violet?"
"Not yet. Maybe half an hour, if that's okay. I thought I'd show Katie around first."
"That's just fine,"
said Mr. Willow. He touched Violet's shoulder and gave it a gentle squeeze.
"You know how we appreciate everything you do for us."
Violet ducked her head and stepped back, her cheeks pink. I glanced away. I wasn't the only one averting my eyes. Lyle was staring fixedly at the floor. He only looked up when Esme made a small animal sound in her throat. She lifted her head and turned slowly, so very slowly, to look at me. Lyle took her hand and held it. To me, he said,
"You're upsetting her."
"Oh," I said, "I'm sorry."
"She doesn't like strangers," Lyle said. "Esme is closer to angels than most of us ever will be," said Mr. Willow.
It sounded like a non sequitur, but his voice glowed with so much fondness, so much pride. It was like a father praising his daughter for an unexpected accomplishment. If it weren't for his shadow cowering and quivering, tucked away like a rodent in a burrow, I would have sunk into the warmth of it. Mr. Willow's tone was familiar, almost conspiratorial, when he turned to me and said,
"It is her gift and her curse, because it means she's closer to demons as well."
I blinked.
"We're so glad you found your way to us, Katie,"
he went on,
"even if only for a little while. Go on with Violet and have a look around. The sun is coming out."
He knew. I didn't know how. I had no idea what he saw when he looked at me.
I had to look away first.
He knew. It was impossible. Nobody knew what I was. I had hitchhiked halfway across the country without anybody noticing. I was being paranoid. Paranoid and stupid and irrational. I might have convinced myself of it, too, if I hadn't seen what Mr. Willow couldn't see. Behind him, behind his open expression and relaxed posture, his kind smile and kind eyes, Lyle was clutching Esme's hand so hard their joint grip was trembling, and his face was pinched with rage. Esme's lips worked, but no sound came out. A shiny line of drool gathered at the corner of her mouth. Her upper lip pulled back in a snarl, revealing white teeth and red gums. Violet touched my arm.
"Come on, Katie."
At once, Lyle's expression cleared.
the anger replaced by a mild mask. He wiped his sister's mouth and patted her knee.
"I'll show you the church," Violet said. "How does that sound?"
I tried to smile.
"That sounds great."
Chapter 13. The rain had stopped, and the sun was shining through the clouds in bright rays. The prairie smelled fresh, clean, not a hint of manure or fertilizer. Violet skipped between the driveway puddles, stopped after a few feet, looked at me, and laughed.
"I'm sorry. I'm just tired of being stuck inside. It's hard getting used to being all the way out here, where it's so quiet."
"Have you been here long?" My voice was steady, but my throat was tight. I didn't let myself look back to see if Mr. Willow was watching.
"Not long. We used to have a church in Colorado," Violet said. "In Boulder. That's where the congregation started. But it was... it's a little remote here, but it's better. I like it."
On the playground, the kids had moved from the swings to the merry-go-round, and the woman's umbrella was folded up and tucked under her arm. Beyond the playground, the old man in the brown hat was still standing by the church graveyard. He hadn't moved at all. The woman turned toward us as though she was going to say something, but her gaze flicked over me and she spun away.
"That's Gail," Violet said.
If the woman heard, she gave no sign.
"She's still getting used to it."
"Getting used to what?"
"To who she is now," Violet said. "It can be hard to give up something that's hurting you, even if you know how much harm it's causing. Mr. Willow is letting her stay here for a while, until she's feeling better. The children help, I think. She likes watching them."
"Drugs," I thought. She was talking about drugs. The coded language, the damaged people with blank stares, all the unsmiling photographs in the hallway. This was a halfway house for addicts. That's what Danny had seen when he looked at me, unwashed and bedraggled and alone in my ill-fitting clothes, stranded at a truck stop between nowhere and nowhere. He had looked at me and thought, "Hey, there's a girl who needs to break a really bad habit." That's what Mr. Willow and Violet thought I was. The merry-go-round creaked as the kids pushed it around. They were a boy and a girl, about the same age, maybe twins. They weren't talking or laughing or making any noise at all. There was only the faint squeak of the merry-go-round. "Where are their parents?" I asked.
"Their mother isn't ready to give up everything she's holding on to," Violet said. "She's a danger to them, for now. They're better off with us."
When I glanced back, I saw Gail's face in profile. Sharp, almost bird-like. The briefest flash of teeth when she hissed at the children, hidden again when she fell silent. "How long have you been with the congregation?" I asked.
"Long enough that it feels like I never belonged anywhere else," Violet said. "Here we are."
She climbed the steps of the church and reached for the wide wooden doors. I was right behind her, but I stopped as soon as the doors were open. There was no movement in the air, no change in pressure. But I felt something flowing out of that church like breath from a gaping mouth. So sudden and so strong, I backed down one step and caught the railing for balance.
"Katie, are you okay?"
"Fine," I said between gritted teeth. Still holding the railing, I started up the stairs again. Goosebumps rose on my skin and I grew nauseated with the effort.
"It's okay,"
Violet said. There was a mournful edge of disappointment in her voice.
"You only have to come as far as you can."
If I had been paying attention, I would have realized what a strange thing that was to say. But all I could think was, I shouldn't be here. I was as certain of that as I was of all the other new truths in my world. I had been dead, and now I wasn't. My heart could stop, and it wouldn't hurt me. I didn't need food or drink or sleep anymore. Murderers dragged shadows of guilt behind them for the rest of their lives.
I could kill with a touch. I shouldn't be here.
It's okay,
Violet said again. I was breathing heavily when I reached the top of the steps. 6 broad church steps, and I felt like I had sprinted up a hill.
Can you come inside?
My throat was raw.
I'd rather stay out here. I think you should come inside. This is our way of being sure.
Violet reached for my hand. We stood side by side, backs to the road and the endless prairie, looking at those open church doors. There was a smear of reddish-brown paint across the threshold, stretching from one side to the other. When Violet stepped over the threshold, I did too, suppressing the quiver of nausea that rolled through me. There were boxes and chairs stacked inside. The vestibule was being used for storage. Sunlight slanted through high stained glass windows, illuminating a room cluttered with old furniture and crooked pews. Nobody had held services in that church in a long time.
I know it's frightening, Violet said. You have a darkness in you.
A darkness. I almost laughed, but I couldn't make a sound. The darkness wasn't inside me. No priest standing over my childhood bed could call out demons while my parents watched in fear and hope. There was no voice whispering in my mind, no being controlling my body.
It's like a cancer, Violet said. It's inside you, this terrible thing. Maybe it feels like it's part of you, but it isn't. It isn't, Katie. That's the lie it's telling you. You won't be free until you cut it out. Whatever you are, we can help you.
I don't need help. My voice was hoarse. I'm not. I had seen beneath my own skin. I had opened wounds in my own guts. I knew what was there. Inside of me was flesh and blood and bile and bone, same as it had always been. The darkness was all around, in the endless sky, in the crumbling soil of an empty grave, in the grasping shadows that clung to people who had done terrible things.
I'm not possessed,
I spat out the word, but if I expected it to hit Violet like a blow, I was disappointed. I don't have a demon inside of me.
I know you don't, she said. That's only an easy way to think of it, for people who are too scared to understand. But you don't have to be scared. Just because you've always been this way doesn't mean you have to stay like this. Let us help you, Katie.
I thought, but I haven't always been this way. And I thought, that isn't me. But what I said was,
how? What can you do?
Violet was quiet for a long time. Clouds drifted over the sun. The inside of the church dimmed, darkened, brightened again.
We all used to be like you,
she said. I felt a spark of wild hope.
You?
Yes.
Exactly like me?
The painful shrieks, the bloody ears. I couldn't do that. Whatever Violet was, or had been, it wasn't the same.
Oh no, not exactly. There are so many different kinds of darkness.
But you... I swallowed. There was a sharp, sour taste at the back of my throat.
But you're not anymore. You're not... what you were?
Mr. Willow helped me, Violet said. I'm not anything but ordinary now.
I had a dozen more questions, 100, clamoring and clashing in my mind. What Violet was telling me, if it was true, was fantastic. It was incredible. There were other things like me in the world. I hadn't dared imagine it might be possible. But that's what she was saying. Ever since I had woken up, I had assumed that dying was like walking through a one-way door. I had come out the other side as something else, something inhuman and different, and most of all, alone. It hadn't occurred to me there might be others. I hadn't thought I might go back. Violet was still holding my hand, so tight I felt my bones grind. Her palm was damp. There were tears in her eyes. If it was true.
That's what he's done for all of you?
I said.
That's what we do. We can help you too.
What about Esme?
Silent Esme, growling Esme with the towel tucked into her shirt.
Had they done that to her?
Was that their idea of help?
Did Mr. Willow help her too?
Violet didn't answer. And that woman upstairs? Those kids out there? What did you do to them? What kind of help? You have to tell me something. Violet, please!
Mr. Willow helps them, Violet said.
How? What does he do?
He doesn't do it himself. He's not alone. None of us are alone. He takes them, us, to a friend. A very special friend. Not here,
she added, when I glanced around the church.
She stays somewhere else, where she can be safe. Whatever we are when we go to her, we come back better.
Mr. Willow? He used to...
Oh, no, no, not him. He's human. He only wants to help.
What about Esme? What did she used to be?
She was...
Her voice caught, choked with an emotion I couldn't identify.
Dangerous.
I thought of all the photographs in the house, the vacant expressions, the empty eyes. Decades of photographs. Dozens of people, if they were even people anymore inside those blank shells. Charming Mr. Willow was human. Helpless, drooling Esme was dangerous. I was cancer and darkness. None of us were special or alone. That's what Violet was telling me. I remembered, suddenly, with a painful shiver, the day my father took me to an empty parking lot to teach me to drive, to change a tire and check the oil, and how he had laughed when I drove over the curb trying to parallel park, and laughed again when I hit my own nose with the jack handle. He had reached over to muss up my hair. I had squirmed and protested, "Dad, don't!" And he had said, "It's all right, Breezy. At least we know you'll always have your brains." He couldn't have known how right he was. I might be dead. I might be walking around with a heart that didn't have to pump and a touch that could kill. But I was still me. And I didn't like the picture Violet was drawing. I couldn't know how many of Mr. Willow's people were like Violet, functional and sensible, and how many were like Esme or the silent children on the playground. I wanted to believe it was possible. I wanted to believe Violet was proof of that. But what would it matter, to have flowing blood and sucking breath again, if it turned my mind to mush? What would it matter, to discover I wasn't alone, if all I could do with that knowledge was watch silent children drift listlessly on rusty swings? I didn't trust those odds. The only help I need, I said, speaking slowly, is a ride to the bus station. I expected her to argue, but Violet only squeezed my hand.
If you're sure.
I am. She lifted her free hand to my face, and I flinched. She touched my jaw and leaned close to whisper,
"You have to run."
I looked at her in surprise. But
you have to run. You can't go back to the house.
My stuff, I began.
Forget it. You can't go back. He won't let you leave.
She released my hand to take my elbow, turned me around to face the church doors again.
You have to go now.
But when we emerged from the church, Mr. Willow was waiting.
I was wondering where you went, he said.
He smiled up at us, so warm,
So convincing. His combed hair had been teased out of place by the wind.
It's time to come in and talk about your plans, Katie.
We'll be right in,
Violet said. Willow's hands were tucked into his pockets. He looked up at the sky, squinting in the patchy sunlight.
It's turning into a beautiful day, isn't it? There'll be plenty of time to talk after lunch.
Violet let go of my elbow.
In a minute, Edward. We're looking at the church.
Mr. Willow looked at me,
and at once I saw what I hadn't seen before. The subtle shift in expression that before had made me think he knew more than he was saying.
He was afraid of me.
Nobody had ever been afraid of me before. Come in now, he said, and his smile was gone. If I gave him a chance, he would take that away.
Violet said, Katie.
I jumped down the church steps in two bounds. I stumbled at the bottom, recovered, and I ran.
Chapter 14. The gravel crunched under my feet and muddy rainwater splashed my legs. Mr. Willow shouted, but I didn't look back. I ran to the end of the driveway. I didn't know which way to go. I picked right, hit the asphalt, and kept running. I couldn't stay on the road. They would catch me in a minute with a car. I veered left, slid into a ditch, and scrambled up the other side. I ducked through the barbed wire and risked a look back. Willow wasn't chasing me. But Lyle was. He was running down the road in long, bounding strides, each one stretching longer than the last. And he was fast. I gaped for too many seconds at the impossible blur of his legs, then shook myself and broke into a run across the field. The ground was muddy and spotted with puddles. I splashed and skidded and crushed young plants beneath my shoes. I wasn't fast enough. Lyle was at the fence. He cleared it in a single jump, and he caught up with me in seconds. He hit my back with such force I felt, heard, something crack. Fiery pain burst through my ribs, and I went down hard. Lyle's hand was on the back of my head, driving my face into the ground. I tried to shout, gulped a mouthful of mud and water instead. It was in my nose, in my throat. Lyle was on my back, his fingers digging into my neck and my side. Not fingers, no, but claws. Sharp enough to tear my clothes and break my skin. He hadn't had claws in the house. I would have noticed claws. I thrashed and kicked, but I couldn't push him off. His breath was hot on my neck. Whatever you are, Violet had said. They didn't know what I was. They didn't know I didn't need to breathe. Against every screaming instinct, I stopped fighting and let myself go limp. I had been here before, mud in my mouth, grit in my eyes. I wasn't even underground this time. All I needed was a chance. I had done it before. I could do it again. Lyle didn't let go, but the weight on my back eased. He flipped me over easily, as though I weighed no more than a doll. The manhandling twisted something in my rib cage, and I gasped, spit the mud from my mouth, and coughed. I swung at Lyle with my free arm, struck him on the side of his face. He cursed and tried to grab my hand, but I was ready for him. I caught his wrist, and I pulled. Nothing happened. There was nothing there. Nothing for me to grasp. Nothing for me to stretch and break. Lyle jerked his wrist away. I grabbed it again.
Nothing. There were no vines of darkness trailing Lyle or gathered about his head like thunderclouds. He wasn't a killer. I couldn't do anything to him. I tried to squirm away, tried to kick at his legs, but he was bigger than me and every bit as strong as he was fast. I bent one of my knees up into his groin. Lyle grunted and loosened his grip just enough for me to